It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Evidently, the restaurant world is still a boys' club where sexism is the rule, not the exception. Chef Amanda Cohen of New York's beloved restaurant, Dirt Candy, weighs in.
I sometimes do feel like I'm treated differently. I've run my restaurant for 6 years, and we are very successful, I think. It takes 2 months to get a reservation. We're opening a new restaurant. But even this past weekend, I had a very cocky young chef mansplain to me how to be more successful, and I think another male chef might have punched him.
The trials and tribulations of female-run restaurants, the Hmong kitchen, and a miracle garlic paste coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Amanda Cohen is the chef owner of New York City's Dirt Candy, where the food is playful, creative, and all made of vegetables. But far from being an earth-toned, retiring vegetarian, Cohen is also a sharp-eyed and very funny critic of celebrity chef culture, the food media, and most pointedly, sexism in the food world. Well, last fall, she took on Time magazine for their cover story on The Gods of Food, which named over 100 chefs, none of which were women. So why is the restaurant world still a boys' club? Splendid Table contributor Frances Lamb met with Cohen to talk about why women chefs sometimes have to fight harder outside the kitchen than in it.
So, Amanda, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you are a busy person. You're still the kind of chef who is in your restaurant cooking, literally cooking every day. But you've taken a lot of time to research the history of women chefs and to write about it. And, you know, I learned from you there was a woman named Eugenie Brasier,
right,
who was the first chef to ever win 6 Michelin stars, which is huge.
Huge.
But I'd never heard. And I'm pretty much a geek about stuff, but I'd never heard of her. So why do you think women chefs have such a hard time getting recognition or attention?
Well, it's sort of this cycle that happens. Women need to be written about to get the attention. And the more attention they get, the more customers that fill their seats. The more customers that fill their seats, the more articles that are written about them. And it cycles and cycles and cycles. Without getting the attention in the press, the investors don't invest in them. And without, you know, getting bigger restaurants, they don't get more articles written about them. So it's just this never-ending cycle. Hmm. I don't know why, like, from the get-go, the press didn't start writing about the women. I can't go back that far in history. But I do know right now that they're still not writing about them.
But you've said before that there's a distinction between being a working chef as a woman and being the kind of chef the media likes to talk about. What does that mean?
Well, I think the media likes to sort of like focus on like the young, brassy, outspoken chefs who have time to step outside their kitchen and network and meet people. Whereas a lot of like the working chefs, we're in our kitchens every single night. There is no time. There's no extra time to leave your kitchen. And also women tend to open smaller restaurants, like the corner shops, mom and pop shops, ethnic restaurants. And we don't have a lot of extra money to spend on PR. So without a big, huge publicity company pushing you out there, how is the press going to find you?
Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel like you're treated differently because you're a woman?
I sometimes do feel like I'm treated differently. I've run my restaurant for 6 years, and we are very successful, I think. It takes 2 months to get a reservation. We're opening a new restaurant. But even this past weekend, I had a very cocky young chef mansplain to me how to be more successful and, you know, what I could do to get investors and how he was able to get investors. And it's because I didn't try hard enough.
And you don't think he would have done that to another male chef?
I think another male chef might have punched him. He was lucky I was a little tipsy.
Is there a difference in your mind between male chefs and female chefs?
No, not at all. I think we cook the exact same way. I hate this argument when we start breaking it down in who's a better cook, or do women cook more nurturing and, you know, men are more out there and they do more like modern techniques. No, everybody cooks the exact same way. Some people have the ability to try new things because, let's say, they have restaurants that have more money behind them, so they're able to take more chances, or they can make fancier menus, they can do tasting menus. Again, women are opening smaller restaurants where they're not always able to take those chances.
Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like every few years there is a conversation that sort of floats in some small corner of the media about, you know, about this idea, this idea of, you know, gender in the kitchen. You've said you don't find the world of cooking to be, quote unquote, a boys' club. What do you mean by that? Because people think of it as it being very male-driven, very, very male-dominated, and very testosterone-y.
Right. Well, I don't think that there's a group of men who are ruling this industry and they sit, you know, in a lounge smoking their cigars saying, hey, I'm a male chef and I'm going to make sure that no other female chef succeeds because I want to stay on top of this. I can't imagine that's what happened. I mean, maybe it does, and I just don't know about the secret society. I've never been invited, but I really don't. I think that most chefs we all have huge egos. We all want to succeed the most, but I also don't want to do it to the detriment of somebody else. You know, I really want everybody else to have the same chances that I have. I imagine the same thing for male chefs. They want to know they're the best chef because they're the best chef, not because they have male genitalia.
Yeah. Like no one wants to win when they know they have when they know they have a leg up.
Yeah, exactly.
A friend of mine who is a woman in the food world once said to me, you know, I hate to say it, but the reason there aren't that many women chefs is actually simple. And she said, you know, to make it as a chef, you have to usually devote your 20s, your strongest years, entirely to the kitchen. And that's when many women want to have families. And so maybe they have children, they decide they need more time with their children, or, you know, like what Sheryl Sandberg talks about.
Right.
They start to think, well, you know, in a few years, I'm going to be out of this anyway, so I don't really, you know, they don't quote unquote lean into it. What do you think of that idea and what can we do about it?
Totally true. I think we have a huge problem in this industry. We do not, and this is going to sound funny, but we're not keeping women in the kitchen. We need to keep women in the kitchen. They don't have to be barefoot, but they have to be in the kitchen. And this is a problem on the industry side. So a lot of the things I talk about is more about in the press. But for us, this is our huge problem. We don't offer, most restaurants don't offer maternity leave. You know, we don't have healthcare in the restaurant industry. It's starting, but it hasn't really happened yet. And this is something that we as restaurateurs have to figure out. How can we keep women in the kitchen? How can we let them go for, you know, 6 months or a year, however much time they want to take off, and then come back and have a decent life, you know, earn a decent salary and be able to spend time with their kids? This is something I think we're going to start figuring out. I think we're going to have to in the next couple of years, but we haven't had to. This has sort of been an unregulated industry. And what's happened is we've lost all this talent. All these great chefs have left in their 20s and early 30s, or at least female chefs, and they haven't come back, or they've gone to different parts of the industry. And what we need to do is find them again and say, hey, show us what you can do.
Right.
This is another one of my big issues, but food costs money. But you're not paying as much as it costs to sit in my restaurant to eat that food. And that's where we're going to start seeing this come out, is that as a community, we're all going to have to agree that our, I don't know, $15 salad might cost $20 if the people who are making it are, we have to decide if they're entitled to have the same rights as we do as a consumer.
Hmm.
So it's a problem for everybody, but we are going to have to tackle it, or we're just going to keep losing people.
Right. Well, thank you so much for coming to talk with us today, Amanda.
No, thank you for having me.
Amanda Cohen is chef owner of Dirt Candy in New York City. Francis Lam is a writer and editor of Cornbread Nation No. 7. So who does Amanda think is the female chef that is really holding her own in the food business? Well, head to the website for more of the conversation. Oh, and check out her signature recipe for portobello mousse. It's all there at splendidtable.org. There are two words that say summer better than almost anything else. Road trip. Strap on the seatbelt, crank up some music, open the windows, and drive. The truly great road trip has to have some truly great road food. And that's where Jane and Michael Stern come in. The duo behind roadfood.com. Jane, Michael, good to have you back, guys.
Great great to be here.
Hi, Lynn. So where have you been? What's the latest discovery?
We have been traveling along the coast of Oregon, which, you know, is such a road food rich part of the country. I mean, every place you stop, there's something good. And the town of Newport is especially good. I mean, the main street in Newport, on one side are the fishing boats. On the other side are the restaurants that serve what the fishing boats bring in. So you can't get any fresher than that. And one of the great restaurants at the far end of the main street in Newport is called Local Ocean. It's a seafood market and a restaurant. And in the seafood market, every kind of fish they sell is marked with a placard that tells exactly which vessel caught it using which fishing technique to bring it in. So you know what you're getting.
So you know if it's line caught, you know if it's
exactly
trawl netting, pots, long line, all those. So I guess this is like farm to table, but it's like wave to table.
Right.
It's boat to table. And the thing is, it's not just fresh, but these people really know what to do with it. I remember the last time we were there, we had a panzanella salad, you know, which is great. You know, fresh tomatoes, everything's terrific about it. But it was topped with skewers with just grilled hunks of halibut on it. I mean, just creamy white halibut. And it was just, to sort of pick up one of those skewers and bite off a hunk of that halibut and then dig your fork into the panzanella salad. It was just heaven. I mean, so fresh, so good, so Oregon.
You know, the genius behind this is a woman named Amber Morris, who is the fish buyer for Local Ocean. And she has a title that I wish I had. She's called the fish goddess, which I think is a wonderful way to describe somebody.
That is, absolutely.
And she cuts out the middleman, buys directly from the fisherman, and, bammo, there it is for sale at Local Ocean.
So is it a sit-down place?
Yes. I mean, there are tables. There are some really nice tables outdoors where, you know, that you're just kind of the air is perfumed by the ocean itself. There are better. What we like better is tables indoors. Even if you're a single diner, maybe especially if you're a single diner, it's great because there are a series of stools where you can sit and watch the people in the kitchen make this great food. And it's just, you know how it is to watch experts cook in a kitchen, knowing exactly what to do, doing six things at once and doing it perfectly. So we love to sit at the counter and watch them, you know, prepare the Dungeness crab suit, crush the garlic that goes into it to give it that really garlicky flavor, construct fish tacos out of the ling cod that they got that morning. I mean, it's literally mesmerizing to sit there and watch and then eat it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do all kinds of things. I mean, they will tempura batter some stuff.
There's a lot of local produce. They use Oregon hazelnuts, which they roast and combine with smoked salmon, local vegetables.
And they make some ice creams there, but forget the ice creams. What you want for dessert is their lemon shortcake, because they top this with Oregon berries, mangoes, and freshly whipped cream. And let me tell you. It's so perfect. It's because it's very fresh and bright and refreshing. And after this, you know, this terrific seafood meal, it is the perfect exclamation mark.
I would say that sounds like it's a go.
Oh, gosh, I want to go there for lunch. I'm only 3,000 miles
away.
Oh, well.
Yes. Guys, it sounds great. Thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. Now find their roadside eating picks at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the mysterious cuisine of the Hmong. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. With all the Asian food we eat in America, can you believe that there's an Asian cuisine we're practically clueless about? Well, we know next to nothing about the Hmong people and their food. Now, part of this is because the Hmong have not had a written language until very recently, as in 1950s. The food has not been documented until Shane Yang and Sammy Scripter put together a book of recipes from all 18 of the Hmong clans. It's called Cooking from the Heart, and I invited them over. Now, they arrived in my kitchen complete with Hmong mortar and pestle, the cone-shaped basket for steaming sticky rice and the vase-shaped rice pot, and of course, bags of greens, chilies, and herbs, and a handmade Hmong knife, more machete than slicer. And we set out to make the national dish. It's called larb. Okay, so what can I do to help?
Everything's clean, so we can chop the onion.
Chang, we don't need all of this mint. We want to save some for a garnish.
All right.
Does that look great?
To make larb, you always have to use mint, cilantro, and green onions.
Yeah.
And it is the national dish of Laos. It's a meat salad that can be made with any kind of meat. We're going to make it with chicken today. And then all of these marvelous fresh herbs, always hot chilies, always toasted sticky rice, powder. We're going to grind that in the coffee grinder that I brought. But always, always the mint.
Mm-hmm.
Writing a book with people that don't have a history of a written language was absolutely fascinating. So for instance, there's clans, Hmong River clans, and if you want to know if you are related to another person, you have to find someone that has the oral tradition for that particular clan, and they can recite back for, you know, ancestors and ancestors what the lineage is, only oral, and they still don't write it down. It's still not in books. And I was the outsider, so I did all the interview. I was always interviewing people, and I would ask the old people what was important. What was important for our cookbook? And I had more than one grandmother tell me, we don't need to write it down. We know how to do our cooking, and if we choose to cook another way, well then, that's what we'll be doing then. We don't need to have it written down. This particular dish is almost always made when you have a lot of company.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would have 20 women in the kitchen chopping and
chopping mixing together.
And then the men would be out on the back porch with the big knives chopping the meat.
When you're eating this, would this be served as one of many, many dishes? Or could I make larb for supper? And with sticky rice?
Yes.
And that's dinner?
With some broth, perhaps?
Yeah, you have to have some broth. So my family, we eat about between 3 to 5 dish every night. And larb probably won't be one of our entree. We can have fish, pork, or beef, or chicken. Then I will do at least 2 veggie dish, one without meat and the other one with meat. And I also will have a soup along with it, and the chili condiment and the rice.
The thing that I was so surprised at in the book was that often the broth you talk about is as simple as just putting lemongrass in water and then cooking vegetable or meat in that water, and that's the broth.
Oh, yeah.
That's so much easier.
Yes, a lot easier. Just put lemongrass in there.
So simple.
And that's it. Very simple.
We chopped and chopped and chopped some more. The room was fragrant with lime leaf and mint. And while we were working, I dug into some controversial recent history. I asked them to tell me the story about Hmong involvement during the Vietnam War.
They were recruited by the CIA, and they formed the CIA's secret army in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And it really changed the structure of Hmong living because the families moved to be close to the air bases in Laos so that they could feed their men who were fighting. And the purpose of the Hmong, the jobs the Hmong men got were to harass the Chinese as they brought supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos.
Right.
And it was a secret. We were not supposed to be doing, these operations in Laos. And so they were our allies. They believed in what we believed in. And they also served as pilots and airmen, and they were the people that rescued downed pilots, American pilots, mm-hmm. that were shot mm-hmm. down over Laos, because they were terrific. They really knew the jungle. They really knew the mountains, and they could rescue a downed pilot and bring them to safety. And then after we pulled out, of course, they were left in a country that was then entirely controlled by the communist forces that they had been fighting, which put them
in terrible peril in enemy territory, mm-hmm. and many of the families did find their way out. They had to go however they could, on foot, a lot of them, crossing the Mekong River, ending up in camps in Thailand. And then over the years, they were relocated by helping agencies, many of them to the United States and many of them to France. So there are people without a country, but that means they've always adapted to being a minority within a majority population, and they've always made the best of whatever situation they land in.
At this point, everything was done except the chicken. Tiny Shane, wielding an honest-to-God Hmong machete, began to furiously chop the chicken on a big wooden board. She was like a machine, chopping and re-chopping until the chicken was in more of a paste than in bits. It was dropped into an unoiled, flaming hot wok, and minutes later, we were seated at my kitchen table. The lard was arranged on a big white platter with leaves of lettuce, bundles of fresh herbs, mint, coriander, slices of cucumber and lime, and a heaping pile of the chicken, which was mixed with more chopped herbs and the ground toasted rice. The fragrance and the colors were stunning.
I could go as long as I can go.
Oh, that is wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Crunchy and delicious. And it tastes like nothing that you could imagine. It's wonderful. Thank you both.
Well, we really appreciated you having us here. Thank you. It's been a wonderful morning.
You guys can come to my kitchen any time you want.
You sure you mean that?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, at my house, when I serve this, I do serve this as the main, like a hot summer day.
Yeah.
Out on the porch.
Sammy Scripter and Shane Yang are authors of Cooking from the Heart, The Hmong Kitchen in America. Now, you can find the recipe for the chicken larb, Laotian chicken and herb salad that we made, right on the website, splendidtable.org. There's a new garlic sauce in town. Well, actually, it's quite old. It's called toum. It's a garlic paste that Lebanese cooks have been slathering on their kebabs since the first garlic shoot popped up in Lebanese soil. But this is not like anything that you've seen before. The Washington Post's Bonnie Benwick tracked down an authentic recipe for this seemingly magic sauce for their Plate Lab column. Sally Swift got the details.
Hey, Bonnie, nice to have you with us.
Great to be here.
So I have recently discovered the joy of having a big jar of minced garlic with olive oil and salt in my refrigerator for midweek. Now, you have taken that to another level. Can you tell me about this?
Well, I've actually uncovered the secret for a couple of years. I've been buying this garlic paste, known to the Lebanese chef who makes it and other people as toum, T-O-U-M. I'm probably not saying it quite right. Anyway, he sells it in small and big batches in his deli and makes it by the bucketful every single week for his cafe across the hall.
But paste is not what it is. You brought me a little bit. It is fluffy.
It is not. It is really otherworldly. I mean, it's the magic of a really good food processor or Vitamix or Roboku, depending on who you are. And it turns it into something that looks like egg whites. It's that fluffy. It's that light. And the best thing about it is I've learned that it just sort of mellows out the garlic enough, and you can stir it into so many different things. And what it started out being used for was basically to marinate chicken for shawarma. But he's branched out. I've learned to branch out, and I got kind of a little addicted to the stuff. The best thing is I would buy heads of garlic, and I would watch them sprout little green things out of the top, and I would watch them sort of, you know, fall in on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
This garlic paste I can have ready to go in my refrigerator, and I've kept it for a month.
Well, you've brought some into the studio, and it is beautifully fragrant, I have to say. So tell me how you make this.
It's four ingredients. It's a very light canola oil, and the chef, his name is Joseph Kamali, by the way, a longtime embassy chef in D.C., he told me that a lot of people use olive oil, but it tends to make it heavy. And the difference is you might get something that's creamy rather than something really fluffy and light and ethereal like his is. So it's a light canola oil, lots of peeled garlic cloves.
Like how many are we talking here for a batch?
Well, to make about 4 cups, and if you're going to make it, you may as well make it. So for about 4 cups, which lasts me about a month, it takes about 7 heads worth of garlic.
Okay.
And, you know, there are easy ways to peel whole heads of garlic, which we could get into, but and a 1/4 cup of lemon juice and water. That's it.
And you whir it up in a food processor.
Yeah, the sort of cool thing is he showed me, he took me through the steps of the process. It's the way the layering and the way that you put it in the blender or food processor, it makes a big difference, again, between that creamy stuff and this very egg white, fluffy, light stuff.
And tell me how you use it.
Well,
or tell me when you don't use it, it sounds like.
I know. I haven't been kissing a lot of people lately. What happens is I did start marinating chicken with it. Or even because it's so potent, if it's freshly made, I will just slather it on some chicken breasts or some chicken that I'm going to make kebabs with later and put them on the grill. It just commands a whole bunch of flavor in a very short amount of time. So there's no, you know, marinating all day or in the freezer or whatever. Mm-hmm. But lately I've been stirring it into eggs in the morning.
Oh, delicious.
My colleagues love me. With a little bit of creme fraiche and some tomatoes. And, you know, it can taste Greek. It can taste Italian. It can taste, you know, Mediterranean, really. I also spread it on – it's now my go-to base for garlic toast. You know, usually you melt the butter and you stir in the garlic and then maybe you burn it and maybe they're – you know, another thing that I like about it is I'm not chewing on little bits of garlic.
Right.
And I'm not worrying that it's getting, you know, too dark in the pan or whatever. I've also put it in cold and hot soups. The thing is it – you know, it's very light, but it does immediately disperse. Hmm. You don't get a big oil slick. Because really, if you're talking about the garlic suspended in that oil, it's not held in a lot of oil,
right.
The amount that you're using. And I'm talking about using it in teaspoons and a tablespoon at the most. It just depends really what my plans are later for the evening.
Right. And so tell me, what is the way to peel big heads of garlic? What's your trick?
Well, you can do it a couple of ways. You can put them in a big mixing bowl. And put another bowl on top of it so that you're creating kind of a closed ball. You're going to shake it as hard as you can. It makes a lot of noise. And then when you open it up, just about all the peel has fallen away from the individual cloves if you've done it right.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that you can do very easily is soak them. For this recipe, it doesn't matter at all. And that tends to be what I do.
In cold water or hot?
In lukewarm water. And cold water doesn't matter. I usually, just to help things along, I will just sort of disengage that, you know, the root end so that they're free to, you know, float and and let the peels do as
free,
they may in the water.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want to have a bite here. Can I taste this?
Good, good. Now, what Sally's trying is a little bit of the straight up fluffy stuff.
Wow, it is beautiful. It also kind of reminds me of mayonnaise.
Yeah, a little bit. But light, you know.
Oh, my. Delicious and light.
See, now you're done for the day.
Wow, but that is a wallop of garlic.
Yep. And that's a very fresh batch.
Delicious.
Wow. And it's just easy and on hand. And I feel like once you've made it, which, again, really takes about 10 minutes total, you know, you've got it.
And how long does it keep?
Well, our recipe online said about 3 weeks, but I've let it go for a month. And the only thing it does, it condenses just a little bit. It's not quite as fluffy, but still quite nice.
And keep it in the refrigerator.
Absolutely in the refrigerator.
What a great tool. Thank you very much, Bonnie Benwick.
Sure thing.
Bonnie Benwick is deputy food editor and recipes editor at The Washington Post. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Now find that recipe for Tomb on the website splendidtable.org. You never call my name. We are opening the lines for your calls. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, we've got Kevin calling from Troy, Michigan. Kevin, what can I do for you?
Well, I am married with one teenager at home, and I work full-time.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But here comes the bad part. My wife, who used to do all the cooking, was just promoted to a full-time position, leaving her a little time to cook. So it seems I've received a promotion, too, from no cooking to part-time cooking, starting with one night per week so far.
Okay, and the question is?
Well, she's a fabulous cook with a personal recipe collection that spans many three-ring binders. I've tried to jump in there and make some of her recipes, but they seem very involved with sauces and double boilers and the like. I need your help. Where do I start?
All right. I think we need to get you some basics, okay? Some really simple, good, quick recipes. Now, in all modesty, I'm tempted to mention a book we did.
I'll take it.
All right. It's called How to Eat Supper. And the idea behind it is it's a lot of really interesting different dishes, but nothing takes more than a half hour, and just about everything is done with ingredients that you can get at your local, you know, supermarket. Now, there's Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything. There's The Improvisational Cook by Sally Schneider. These are books. All of us have the same goal. Write a darn good recipe that holds your hand and sort of guarantees you that you're going to have success. And at the same time, don't waste your time and deliver great flavor. But there are a couple of techniques you might want to master, because a recipe is great, but if you know the technique behind it, then you can use that technique, change ingredients, but you're still doing the same process.
Sure.
So, for instance, learn how to sauté. If you know how to sauté, that is big shallow pan, little bit of fat in the bottom of it, get it up to medium-high heat and put something in it. It could be a chicken breast, it could be a piece of fish, it could be any meat, okay, that's okay. Basically tender. You sauté things that are generally tender. You usually start out at moderately high heat to sear, and by the way, you do this with vegetables too, to sear, you get a little bit of brown on the outside, and then you knock the heat way down low, like medium low, and if it's protein, which means any meat, fish, or poultry, you cook it slow. So you might do a normal-sized chicken breast 6 minutes to the side, and you'll know it's done when you press it and it's firm. Got not it. Bouncing back, just firm. But if you think sear high heat, then cook low and slow, any protein that you cook is going to turn out to be optimum. It's going to be juicy and it's going to be delicious. When you get that out of the pan, you're going to have little nubbins maybe in the pan. Mm-hmm. Then you can splash in some wine or broth or tomatoes and garlic or whatever you want. Boil that down, scrape it, etc., and you've got a pan sauce.
Wow.
That's a technique. Now, you could also, in that pan as the meat is cooking, could be some onion, could be some mushroom, but don't crowd the pan.
Okay.
Okay? You see what I'm – you see, there's a technique, and now that can become many, many things.
Yeah.
So check out the books. And look at the techniques, and that's going to give you the good start. And then you'll look at her recipes with a different eye.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We're going to be back in a minute with more of your calls and why you now need a science degree to buy sweet corn. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're talking to you this hour, and let's get back to your questions. Connect with us at 800-537-5252, and you can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Let's see who's up. Laura's on the phone from Charlottesville, Virginia. Laura, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. It's great to talk to you.
Well, thank you for calling, ma'am.
I am calling because I have a stick of cocoa that a very good friend of mine brought back from a trip to St. Lucia. And it's about 6 inches long, about half an inch in diameter, and I have absolutely no idea of what to do with it.
Now, it's a stick of cocoa?
Yes, it's a stick of, I don't know if I would call it dried cocoa. It's a dry texture, but it's been molded to look kind of like a cigar. And I've done some research, and it seems like a lot of people talk about grating this into a chai tea-like beverage.
Uh-huh.
And that sounds good, but I was just wondering, you know, what else could I do with it?
Is it? Have you tasted it?
I have tasted it, and it's a pretty, maybe bitter is the right word. It's a pretty unrefined chocolate flavor. It's nothing close to milk chocolate, dark chocolate, baking chocolate. It's
right.
Like,
but are you talking texture or are you talking flavor?
Flavor, more of that. The texture of it is pretty dry and crumbly.
Right,
so
right.
It'd be good for flaking, I would say.
Well, this is what I'm thinking, just out of the top of my head. You've got a piece of salmon, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to just slowly, you know, pan cook that, maybe with a little butter.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot. All right. You pull it out of the pan. You're now going to make a pan sauce. And what you do is you put a few drops of vanilla into that butter, okay? You put a few drops of balsamic vinegar into that, whatever juices are in the pan. And you let that cook down a little until you get a nice, interesting tasting sauce. You pour that over the salmon, right? Spoon a little over. It's not going to be a lot. And then you flake just a little bit of this over it, and you get that bitter chocolate flavor with all that.
Okay.
And I think it could really be delicious because, you know, vanilla with fatty fish like lobster, salmon, scallops, that kind of thing, really fabulous. The balsamic is the sweet yet acidic balance that keeps it from being cloying. Mm-hmm. And then the hit of the bittersweet chocolate. And then the other thing is, think about the Mexican mole sauces, you know, with the chili and the chocolate and the nuts.
Mm-hmm.
You could miniaturize that, doing something with a bit of hot chili and flake this in as, again, a pan sauce or a marinade.
Okay.
It could really be interesting.
Okay.
See what you get. I mean, I would taste it straight.
Mm-hmm.
I would, you know, get it into some kind of liquid where you're making a drink out of it, sweeten it to taste, and see what that tastes like. Because
okay.
It may be really crudely, it may not be highly processed chocolate, but
I don't think it is.
It may be very decent tasting chocolate.
Exactly. The suggestion with the pan sauce, I know my husband will love that. You name like five of his favorite things.
I think it's great fun. First of all, that sauce without the chocolate is really nice, and it doesn't have to have a lot of fat in it. It's just really interesting. But you do that with a little flaking of this on at the end. It's going to be tasty. Or just melt it in and see what happens.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy.
Bye.
You know, this is such an interesting thing because as Laura and I were talking, we found a blog on St. Lucia about a cocoa tea, which is evidently a really popular drink there. And what it is that it's grated into water or milk and cinnamon spices are added, and it's considered to be very healthy. So interesting idea. I mean, it sounds like almost the way you would do a Mexican hot chocolate. Very traditional drink. And it's perfectly logical that that would have spread to the islands. But try it. I mean, do this even with your own cocoa. Cinnamon, milk. I like star anise, by the way. And see what it tastes like. Anyway, Jennifer, who's in Frisco, Texas, wants to know, there are so many different kinds of mortar and pestles out there. What would I recommend her buying? Well, you're in the part of the world where you can get my favorite mortar and pestle. It's the three-legged stone Mexican mortar and pestle. And I may mispronounce this, but I think it's called a mocajete. Now, you want one that does not have a lot of grit. And generally what you do is you have to kind of temper these babies. What a lot of people do is they put in coarse salt into the mortar and pestle and they grind it and grind it. And this also picks up any excess dust and bits of stone that are in there. And then they rinse it and they do this a couple of times and eventually it smooths out. I pound spices in mine. It comes with a pestle that is really like a figure eight. It has two dome surfaces on either end and it's short and it's stubby. I grind my spices. I make all my crushed herbs. I start all my curries in it because it crushes things like garlic and ginger and chilies brilliantly. So I use it, as I said, everything you could imagine that you could crush or grind, I do it in that instrument. And they're not very expensive. And you're in a part of the country where you'll have a lot of choice. Enjoy. We've got Harville calling from Covington, Louisiana. Harville, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
That's fine, Lynn. Yeah, perfect.
Oh, great. What can I help you with, sir?
Well, the family is planning on going into a commercial barbecue operation where we're going to do, you know, the slow hickory smoked type barbecue.
Right, right.
Ribs, roast, chicken, those kind of things. So my question to you is regarding the chicken. I'm suggesting that we cook the chicken whole. That way I think it will retain more moisture, lose less moisture, and come out and cut it up after it's cooked.
Right.
So what I'm asking is, while it's smoking slowly, is there something that you might suggest that we can put in the cavity of the chicken to give it another flavor, you know, something that's going to give it a little more...
character.
Yeah, a little more character. Correct.
Well, you know, I never know if... Because I have roasted chickens with a whole lemon inside.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if I cut up that lemon and put it inside the chicken, it does seem to flavor it very slightly, but not a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to discourage you because, for instance, if you stuff that chicken with chili peppers that you cut up, you'd get flavor.
Reaction.
It has to be something that's relatively strong. Now, a cut up orange with a ton of garlic, for instance, that's going to perfume it. But if the chicken sits overnight before you cook it, with a stuffing like that, with a flavoring like that, then it permeates the chicken. So you could do garlic, you could do cut up citrus combined with garlic, because both of these things go together and they have a real distinctive quality that may permeate, that should permeate the bird overnight. And or something like, something if you want spice, chili. Now, by the way, the chili isn't going to make it intolerably hot.
Yeah, I don't want to change the flavor. Just another,
another dimension. Another dimension.
That's right. When you eat this chicken, you're going to say, what is that?
There's another. Yeah, I don't know what that is. What is it?
Right.
Are you brining before you do this?
No.
Okay. Here's where you can get the flavor in. The brining's going to do two things. First of all, it's going to keep the chicken very juicy.
Yeah.
Secondly, it's a wonderful way of injecting flavor. And I'm trying to remember, if you go on our website, I did a whole sort of brining guide. And I think if you go on our website and just go to the recipes and put in brine, you're going to come up with quite a few possibilities. But I always blank on the exact proportion of salt to water.
Uh-huh.
But let's say for argument's sake, for every cup of water, you're going to be doing quantity. For every quart of water, you might want, let's say, a half a cup of coarse salt. It could be kosher salt. It could be sea salt. Kosher is cheaper. And for your operation, it makes more sense.
I see.
You don't want iodized salt. And then, so let's say, a quart of water, a half a cup of salt, and then what you want, and that may be too much, but let's say salt, a little less quantity of sugar. Brown sugar is great because it has that caramel overtone.
Yeah.
Then, right there, you could stop, and you're going to have a moist chicken. It's not going to taste sweet, but it's going to have just a soft flavor to it. It's going to be delicious. The thing you want to add to it, though, I always add, for instance, a half a cup of chili powder, not cayenne, something milder.
Chili.
You don't get chili out of it. You just get this, as you said, I don't know what makes this chicken's place so good.
Right.
If you want to add herbs, you add a ton of whatever you're going to add. If you wanted to have a garlic undertone very slightly, you'd add 10 cloves of garlic.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do that quart of water, I would add maybe a quarter of a cup of chili powder. Whatever seasoning you want, add a generous amount of it. Brine a whole chicken. Let's say it's a 3.5-pound chicken.
Mm-hmm.
You want to brine it for no more than, let's say, 3 hours.
3 hours?
Yeah. Don't brine it overnight because you'll have pickled chicken. Two things are going to happen. You're going to have great flavor in the chicken, and it's going to stay moister.
Right, and that's what we're looking for.
Exactly. Obviously. And this is a safeguard. And a lot, it's a trick a lot of producers use because it keeps that chicken moist, but you can also inject flavor. And I think that's the way you should go instead of putting something in the cavity.
I see. Okay, wonderful. I knew you'd have the solution.
Good luck with the business.
Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome, Harville. Bye.
Bye-bye.
800-537-5252. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter. Food keeps getting more complicated. I mean, take sweet corn. It's no longer just enough to buy directly from the farmer or to pick it yourself. You need to get an ag degree to figure out what kind to buy because each of the new varieties tastes different. Here's a rundown of what's at my market right now. Sugar enhanced, super sweet, synergistic corn, and augmented corn. Well, to sort things out, Dr. Bill Tracy, professor and chair of the agronomy department at the University of Wisconsin, joins us. Corn is his beat, new breeds his focus. Professor Tracy, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Could you please sort out these differences? What is the difference between and the taste difference between, well, let's go down the list, all right? The corn we knew 30 years ago, the old, in quotes, I call it the old-time corn.
Right. That has a gene called the sugary gene, and what the sugary gene does, it's kind of misnamed. It's really not that sweet. The sugary corn, the old-timey corn, which I call sugary corn, is actually got a gene that produces a chemical called phytoglycogen. It's a perfectly safe chemical. Instead of making starch, it makes this creamy phytoglycogen. So when you like that old-fashioned corn, you like that creamy texture, and that's what you're getting.
So the sweet, and it would lose its sweetness fairly quickly.
Oh, it loses its sweetness so fast. If you leave it on the counter at room temperature, it will lose half its sugar in 24 hours.
Wow.
And that's a problem both for consumers and for farmers, because farmers want to deliver the best product they can. And if a consumer then mishandles the crop, they'll blame the farmer.
Okay. All right. Now, the next one up the scale in terms of sweetness is sugar-enhanced.
Yeah, it was actually first discovered in the maybe mid to late 1970s, and it really became pretty popular, let's say, a decade after that. Sugar-enhanced actually has the old-timey sugary gene, so you still get that creaminess, but it also has another gene called the sugary-enhanced gene, which makes it significantly sweeter than the old-timey corn. But a lot of people like that. In fact, it's my favorite kind of corn because you still get that creaminess. You get the – generally, they're very tender. And this is what we see a lot in general at our roadside stands today because it gives a very high-quality product. The problem, again, is just like the old-fashioned ones, it's going to lose its sugar very quickly if you don't refrigerate it.
Okay, then we go from there – to the super sweet corns. This is the one I have to tell you. I think you don't taste corn, you just taste sugar. But what is this one about?
The super sweets were discovered maybe 20 years before the sugar enhanced, 1950s, 1960. And the super sweets have a different gene. They don't have the old-fashioned sugary gene. They instead have a gene called shrunken 2, and shrunken comes from what the kernels look like when they're dried. What the shrunken 2 gene does is it knocks out any synthesis of complex carbohydrates like polysaccharides, like starch or phytoglycogen, and instead you get an accumulation of sugar. So you're absolutely right. You do get this increase in, a significant increase in sweetness. The major advantage of this kind of corn to farmers, grocery stores, long-distance shippers, those kind of folks, is this kind of corn holds its sugar for a very long time. Now, as you said, it's going to be very sweet, but that's what people are generally preferring these days. And younger people generally like sweeter things, and I think that's
interesting.
You probably find that across all the foods that you deal with.
Aha. Now, synergistic corn.
Synergistics. So I told you about three different genes, sugary 1, sugary enhancer, and shrunken 2.
Right.
Synergistics are a combination of those. And what those synergistics try to do, so let's say that 75% of the kernels on the ear are old-timey sugary kernels, so you get that nice texture, and 25% of them are super sweet, so you get the super sweet sugar. So that's a way to try to get increased sweetness, but also get that nice texture that you're missing in the modern super sweets.
I'm going to feel so smart when I go to the farmer's market and say I'd like to have synergistic corn.
But they're a little less common. I think we're seeing more of the augmenteds. And the augmenteds are interesting because the augmenteds generally are actually putting all those genes together in the same kernel. And you're getting, in many cases, the augmenteds are definitely an improvement over the super sweets. You get more corn flavor, better texture, better tenderness.
Well, thanks for clearing up something that's been confusing for a long time.
My pleasure.
Bill Tracy is the chair of the agronomy department at the University of Wisconsin. Now, test out all the corn varieties with our recipe for charred ginger chili corn. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for listening. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Henry David Thoreau. I believe in the forest and in the meadow and in the night in which the corn grows. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, anything you need can pretty much be found on splendidtable.org. Find more information on anything you heard here today, get recipes for any occasion, register for our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and take a look at our e-books, Eating In with Lynn. It's all there, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.